Made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stansel. Once again, in this hour of the show, we're offering a Focus 580 archive interview. That means that in this part of the program, we will not be taking your calls. In the first hour today, we'll be bringing you the story of one of history's most spectacular frauds, although I say there's probably a pretty good chance that most of the people listening this morning have never heard this story. It was engineered by a man who called himself Sir Gregor MacGregor, and the story goes something like this. One morning in 1823, a group of Scottish immigrants set out from Scotland by boat in search of a better life. They were headed for Central America, for a nation called Poye, where they expected to find fertile soils, a balmy climate, and beautiful cities. They spent 2 months on that ship, and when they got across the water, very quickly they realized that there was no such place. It didn't exist. The story this morning is told in a book that we will talk about. The title is The Land That Never Was, Sir Gregor MacGregor and the Most Audacious Fraud in History. And the author, our guest, David Sinclair. It's published by the Da Capo Press. David Sinclair is the author of 8 previous books, including the recent Hall of Mirrors and also a bestseller titled The Pound, a biography. He's had a long career as a senior journalist in some of Britain's leading newspapers and divides his time between London and Normandy and is talking with us this morning from France. Mr. Sinclair, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's a great pleasure.
Maybe to begin, I would ask you if you could talk a little bit about these folks who were on this boat who left Scotland and sailed across the Atlantic expecting to find Poye, this place that had been sold by Sir Gregor MacGregor. Tell me what it was that they thought, you know, when that boat came in sight of the shore, what they were expecting to see?
Well, they were expecting to see a developed colony with farms and coffee plantations and sugar plantations, and there were a lot of friendly natives who would welcome them and would eventually work for them. And they were also expecting to find a sort of European-style capital city called St. Joseph, which reputedly had housed the National Bank, had an opera house, had the sort of boulevards that you think of as being, you know, Parisian, and a wonderful climate.
And when they indeed got there, what did they find?
They found, to put it in a word, they found a swamp. That's all there was. They had anchored one evening, late-ish in the evening, after their 2 month journey. And they could see in front of them a beautiful lagoon and some mountains in the background and palm trees and mangroves and other exotic types of trees. And it all looked very beautiful in the evening. And they thought that perhaps the following morning there would be some sort of official welcome for them by the government of this country, Poye. But when the sun rose in the morning, all they could see was, apart from the trees, was just this flat swamp with no sign of a village, a house, a farm, or anything else.
Hmm. What sort of people were these?
Many of them were farmers. They had a very hard life. Many of them were tenant farmers because at that point there were many English landlords in Scotland, and rents were rising quite rapidly. And it was quite difficult for them to make a reasonable living. Some of them had owned their own land, but again, often the land wasn't very good, and you know, all it would support was sheep. Agricultural prices were pretty low at the time, and so they'd either given up their tenancies and taken their life savings to go to Poye, or they had sold their farms and done the same. Others of them were people, many of them were ex-soldiers, because the Napoleonic Wars had just finished. You know, we're talking about the early 1820s. And so a lot of men had been released from the army, and they found it extremely difficult to get work. in Britain. And they'd been hired as laborers and artisans and craftsmen by, they thought, the government of Poye.
Well, as I said, this was all engineered by this man who called himself Sir Gregor MacGregor, the man who showed up in London and said that he had been given a large tract of land, an enormous amount of land, by the ruler of this, the native ruler of this territory, and had been made a prince, and that it was his intention, that is, Sir Gregor's intention, to develop this land, and he particularly wanted to give his fellow Scots an opportunity to get in on this. Now, it's all well and good to show up and say, well, you know, this ruler on the other side of the Atlantic has given me all this land, and I'd like to share it with you and develop it, and why don't you get on a boat and sail across the Atlantic? How is it that he persuaded people, that he established, in fact, that this set of circumstances were true?
Well, he brought with him a lot of documentation. He brought with him a map, obviously, of Poye, because people needed to know roughly where it was. So he could point to the map and say, look, this is the land you bought. He brought with him also a grant from the king of the Mosquito Shore, the native chief. There was actually a genuine king of the Mosquito Shore. There's a long line of native kings there. And the chances are that this grant was genuine. The grant of this, I think it was 600,000 acres or something. It was a huge amount of land, as you said. And so he had that with him. And he also had a guidebook to Poye, which was a very detailed, very large, very handsome book, leather-bound, which told people everything they might want to know, what the land was like, what sort of crops it would grow, what the climate was like, the trees, the natural resources. It talked about gold mines and silver mines, and it talked about navigable rivers and all this sort of thing. It was a very, very impressive book. And you have to remember that in the early 19th century, as far as the media were concerned, things weren't all that different from the way they are now. So there was very much a kind of cult of celebrity in much the same way as we have now. And when this exotic prince, as he called himself, arrived in Britain in 1820, the papers were full of it. And when he went back to Scotland, you know, because he was a native Scot, There were long reports about his life in the Scottish newspapers, and they were picked up by the English newspapers. There were articles about him in magazines. There were engravings of him and his wife, who was herself South American. And so they were very much a kind of golden couple.
Hmm. Well, it certainly seemed to have helped the fact that he was dashing. He looked the part of the military hero. He presented himself very well. He sold himself very well. He had this beautiful wife. And it seems to be a case where his personal appeal and charisma helped him to sell the story.
I think that's always true in these kind of situations. He must have been a pretty impressive character. And he had a habit of dressing very, very well. He had his clothes specially made. He had uniforms made for himself. He was fortunate when he arrived in England to be taken up by society, and he was offered accommodation at a rather splendid English country house in what is now a suburb of London, but which was then, very much a country estate, a beautiful house with a very famous garden and an owner who was very well connected. So he had all the trappings of the great man, and people responded to that, as they would now.
Hmm. It seems that it was a time when the idea of speculation was very strong, and that for some people, the appeal here would not have been personally to go to Poye, but somehow to find a way to profit from the development of this land. And I think that probably was the case with a lot of people who were highly placed in society that were drawn to this man. They weren't going to move across the ocean, but they thought there would be money to be made here.
Absolutely, because what was happening was that because after the revolutions in South America, the Spanish monopoly on trade with the continent had been broken, and so everything was up for grabs. anybody who had money could invest in, and there were many other schemes related to South America at that time. So it was a hot property. Financial journalism had more or less just started in England at the time, and so people gave share tips. They gave tips about things that you could, you know, investments, different sorts of investments. And South America was the big, big thing at the time because of the withdrawal of the Spanish. And so speculation was absolutely huge at the time. And also, at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, there had been a bit of an economic depression. But by now, there was a lot of money swilling around. And people were slightly reluctant to invest in Europe because of the recent wars. And they were looking for other places to put their money.
Mm. It's really remarkable that he managed to persuade people to give up everything they had and get on a boat and sail across the Atlantic. He also persuaded the people at a prominent London bank to give him a loan of £200,000. Now, is that £200,000 then or £200,000 now?
£200,000 then.
So how much is that today?
It's worth about $8 million now.
So he managed to get a loan of $8 million. It seems secured only by his reputation.
It does seem incredible. I mean, when I first heard this story, the sort of bones of the story, I simply didn't believe it. I could not believe that this man could have appeared more or less from nowhere and have gone into the city of London and have been able to raise this amount of money on the basis of a couple of bits of paper and a guidebook. But that is nevertheless the case. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the new revolutionary governments in places like Colombia and Venezuela were also floating loans on the London market at the time to finance the reconstruction of their countries. And McGregor cashed in on this and said, look, I've got another country here which is in much better shape than Venezuela or Colombia. And so you need to put some money in this, and you'll get huge returns. And as we know, as we have recent evidence of the way that people will invest in things to make a quick buck.
Hmm. We are talking here about 1823. I guess I find myself wondering when this became I'm assuming that this was a big story in London and people were talking about it and getting very excited about it. I would imagine there would have been someone familiar enough with Latin America to have raised some question about whether or not what Sir Gregor was promising was actually legitimate. Did anyone stand up and say, wait a minute, we're not really sure this guy's on the level?
There were one or two very small voices of people, mostly who had suffered from earlier speculative bubbles, who said, they didn't say, we're not sure this guy's on the level. What they said was, just be careful, think twice before you put your money into it. But in fact, the financial press, I haven't been able to find a single critical article in the financial press of the time until it became evident that something had gone wrong. So there was this whole fever which was supported. And of course, bear in mind that financial journalists in those days often received sums of money from people who wanted them to push various investments, wanted them to write favorable articles. There was little distinction between journalism and public relations. And journalists were not particularly well paid or particularly well thought of in society, so that if they if they could make a little bit on the side by pushing some particular share or some particular loan issue or some particular scheme, then it was quite likely that they would do it. And the investment community wanted to believe in it. You know, South America, as I said, was the sort of it was the second coming of El Dorado, really, because it was assumed that there were huge amounts of money to be made from trade with South America, both with goods from South America and with sending British goods out to South America to help to develop the countries, the newly independent countries out there.
Mm. It's remarkable just how much this real life story makes me think of fictions. Well, the thing it makes me think of is Anthony Trollope's book, The Way We Live Now.
Yes.
That it's very much like a real-life version of that
yes.
story.
That's absolutely true. And I mean that was rather later, and it was more to do with railways. But it was a very, very similar thing that happened in England at the time, and very often in fact, if I remember correctly, it was in North America or South America that the railway scheme in Trollope's book was.
I think it was in North America.
I think it was in North America, but there were similar schemes in South America as well. There was a scheme I seem to remember for a Pacific railway down the coast, and various other things. And so, from that point of view, there are similarities. What is striking about McGregor is it is the only time that I've come across in studying various frauds where somebody sold an entire country, mm-hmm. an entire fictional country.
And amazingly enough, Sir Gregor himself, this $8 million or loan aside that he managed to get, he didn't become rich himself.
No, he didn't. And I don't think that was entirely his main idea in selling Poirier. I mean, yes, he did want to become rich, but he used a lot of the money that he raised to charter ships to take out the immigrants. This was turned out to be the big flaw in the scheme. If he had simply raised a loan against Poirier and disappeared, he would have been a very rich man. But he was a much more complex character than that, and I think it was a fantasy he had in his mind. He claimed, and I've not been able to establish this definitely, but he claimed to have had an ancestor who was involved in the Darien scheme in Panama in the previous century. And that was a complete disaster. It was a similar thing, except that Darien actually did exist, and it was an official Scottish expedition that set out there. And the whole thing was a disaster, and the Scottish economy collapsed as a result of it, and it was one of the reasons why Scotland had to join with England to become the United Kingdom, because the economy was in such bad shape. And I have a sense that McGregor felt that he was replaying that scheme and would make a greater success of it.
So it wasn't just a pure swindle. He did have in his mind the idea, perhaps misguided, that perhaps this kind of development, the idea that he sold, actually could happen.
I think he did. I can't quite understand how he thought the psychology would work. He must have thought that by sending immigrants out to Poirier, that they would settle down and make the best of it. They would realize that it wasn't quite what they had expected. In fact, it wasn't at all like they expected. But I think he must have felt that they would somehow make the best of it. The problem was that where they actually landed, which was where they had been told to land, was completely inhospitable. There was no water, there was no soil to be cultivated. They couldn't have created farms there because it was simply swamp, mosquito-ridden swamp, and they'd have had to go quite a few miles into the interior through dense jungle before they could actually have done anything. Mm. But I think somewhere in his mind he had the idea that Poirier would be created. Of course, the problem was that although he had been given this land grant by the Mosquito King, it had been done at some sort of drunken party, as far as I can establish. But he had not been given any authority to sell land. So the whole thing would have collapsed anyway, because some time later, when it emerged what McGregor was doing, the Mosquito King actually rescinded his grant and had it published in the London papers to say, this man has no right to be selling any land in my country. So it was never going to work, really, but somewhere in McGregor's mind was the idea that he was going to create and rule a new British or preferably Scottish colony. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Sinclair. If you'd like to read this story, you look for his book, The Land That Never Was, Sir Gregor McGregor and the Most Audacious Fraud in History. That's the title and subtitle. It's published by DeCapo Press. David Sinclair is the author of 8 previous books, including the recent book Hall of Mirrors, and also a bestseller entitled The Pound, A Biography. And he has had a long career as a senior journalist in some of Britain's leading newspapers. We do have a caller to start in Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Can your guest articulate any connection between the paradigm used in the law crash and, I think, 1820, or some little time before that, that the imperialist nature of capitalism came into play? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, Mr. Sinclair, can you speak to those questions?
I couldn't catch the first part of the question.
I'm not really quite clear on it myself.
You mean the Wall Street crash?
I think that's what the caller was talking about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a paradigm which was not to do with McGregor himself, but to do with the nature of speculation. Hmm. I used to be editor of a financial newspaper in London, and I have a sort of theory called the irrationality principle, which is that the more outrageous an investment seems, the more people want to buy it. And I don't think the reason for this has ever been explained, but it seems to operate. And it is true that by the 1820s, or even before the 1820s, there was a distinct relationship between imperialism and capitalism, partly because it was an easy way to make money. In other words, to move into someone else's country and to exploit it. And there's no doubt that that was done. The Spanish had been doing it in Latin America long before the British got there, and long before McGregor got there. So there is a connection there. And of course, the relationship between Poyet and the Wall Street crash is this over-speculation and the buying of securities by people who really couldn't afford to own them and certainly couldn't afford to lose the money. And, of course, there'd been an earlier example in 1720 with the South Sea bubble, which was exactly the same situation, where bogus companies were set up. One of them issued a prospectus saying that it intended to trade with the natives in the South Seas by selling them silk handkerchiefs, and people invested in it. So yes, there is there's an element of exploitation, if you like, on both sides.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering. Maybe the previous caller was wondering about John Law and the Mississippi scheme, and if that. And the settlement of New Orleans, and if that, it seems he was also a Scotsman, and swindled quite a few people out of money, and if, just what comment you might have on that and on McGregor's scheme, if you see any relation between the two.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. John Law was, the difference between McGregor and John Law was that John Law did have some financial expertise, and I actually think that, in a sense, he was less of a confidence trickster than McGregor was. McGregor had no sound basis for Poyet. The whole thing was a fiction. Law, I think, seriously believed in the Mississippi settlement, and he had quite a reasonable reputation in Europe as a banker before all this started. So I think that it was slightly different. I think one of the problems with Law was that, and it happened later, and it's happened even in our own time, is that as subscriptions came in, that money was spent, and so there was nothing to pay dividends or interest or anything else. But there was, it seems to me, insofar as I can remember the details of the scheme, there was a much sounder basis for that scheme than there was for Poyet, which, as I said, was a complete invention.
Yeah, I think Law also ended up penniless.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He ended up in a much worse condition than McGregor did, partly because he was less of a con man.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. We continue. Let's go next to another caller. On line number four, I'm not sure where the caller is. Hello.
Chicago.
Go ahead.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I don't want to sidetrack anything that you've been saying. I just want to add a sidelight, and this is that Warren Buffett, whose name must be familiar to you, was taught by a man at Columbia University named Benjamin Graham. Graham wrote a book on financial analysis right after the crash of 29, during the 30s, early in the 30s, which became the standard text for people going into business and finance and that sort of thing. And that was the first time that finance was ever put on a rational basis. Prior to that, people just guessed, and you know, unless they were on the inside, they just didn't know how to analyze stocks and businesses and that sort of thing. And it was only with Graham that this that financial analysis became something like a science.
Yeah, I think that's I know Graham's book. I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah,
I think one of the problems nowadays, if I may, is that sometimes the analysis is too detailed. I have a friend who runs courses in market psychology.
Yeah.
In Scotland, he has students come from businesses all over the world, and they spend 3 weeks in intensive analysis of how markets behave. But the interesting thing is that it still does not prevent the kind of booms and busts and the kind of scams that we see even today.
Yeah, that we've just witnessed.
That we've just witnessed, right.
Yeah. Okay, that's all I wanted
all
to
right.
add.
Well, thanks for the call. Back at the beginning of the program, we talked a little bit about what happened, and initially what happened to those people who decided they wanted to move to Poirier, who got on the boat in Scotland and came across the ocean, and when they got there, discovered that what they were looking at was not a beautiful developed country with European-style cities, but was a swamp. What happened to these people?
Well, they were there for several months. They realized that there was no way that they were going to make this work. Most of them did, at any rate. Some of them, the working men who'd come from Scotland, thought that they could possibly make a living. Curiously, there were two Americans who were living in the area, not actually where the settlers landed, but some way inland. I haven't been able to determine much about them, but there were two men who had built themselves some sort of house. And were cutting timber. What happened to them, I don't know. And so some of the settlers thought that maybe they would be able to do this. But in fact, the climate began to get the better of them. They didn't have fresh water. They didn't have rum with which to, or any sort of alcohol with which to purify the water. The climate was the beginning of the rainy season, and they hadn't had time to build themselves proper shelters. So they soon became ill with tropical diseases, for which they were, of course, completely unprepared, having come from the cold climates of Scotland. One man shot himself. It gives you an idea of the extent of the illusion that MacGregor had created. This man was a shoemaker from Edinburgh, who had sold his business and fortunately perhaps left his wife and children at home in order to become the official shoemaker to the Princess of Poirier. When he realized that there wasn't the Princess of Poirier and there wasn't a Poirier at all, he shot himself. Most of the others, two or three of them drowned trying to escape from, because their only way out was several hundred miles south where there was a port at Cap Gracias a Dios. Or north, about 500 sea miles, to a British settlement in Belize. And so they tried to build rafts and boats, some of them, to try to escape, and several of them were drowned. Most of the rest became very ill. Some died in Poirier. Some were finally rescued by a British ship from Belize. But when they got to Belize, again, the climate and the diseases claimed the lives of most of them, and I think I'm right in saying that only about 50 ever got back to England.
Hmm. And another really remarkable feature of the story is that apparently at least some of these people, those that managed to survive the experience when they went back, they didn't blame MacGregor. At least they weren't hostile. They didn't want to say that it was his fault, and some of them actually signed a document that said, we don't hold Sir Gregor MacGregor responsible for what happened. That seems fairly remarkable.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying a little earlier about the way McGregor behaved and you know, the style that he had. And I think it's all to do with the English class system. McGregor behaved like an aristocrat. And so they couldn't believe that he would actually do this to them. They assumed that there must be someone lower down the line who wasn't an aristocrat, who was simply in it to make money, who had somehow suborned the whole scheme and fooled McGregor and fooled them. There was a great habit of subservience, which you don't have in America, in England at that particular time. I mean, it still exists to some extent, but much less so. Anyone who presented themselves as being great, who appeared to have the credentials of being great, who had a title, it was a tendency for working people to look up to them and to expect them to behave properly. And as it happened, there were two or three, if we can say this, sort of more upper-class people who were part of the party who landed in Poitiers, and they did not behave particularly well. And I think that the few who got back thought that probably it was their fault rather than McGregor's fault.
So people actually thought that he was as much, some people thought, he was as much a victim as they.
Absolutely. And he actually, rather cleverly, he presented himself as a victim too. By the time the settlers had got back to England towards the end of 1823, he'd skipped over to France with his family, where actually he tried to launch the same scheme again, but that's another story. And he let it be known through the newspapers that he had been tricked by various people. He actually even blamed some of the settlers because he accused them of having stolen one of his ships. But the settlers who finally got back didn't know any of this. And they assumed that the people who had actually led them on the ground, as it were, in Poitiers were at fault.
What ultimately happened to Sir Gregor McGregor?
Well, as I said, I tell the story in the book of how he left England to avoid scandal, moved to Paris, where he joined up with a French company with interests in Latin America and tried to persuade more people to emigrate to Poitiers. But the Napoleonic France was much more bureaucratic than England, and all these people had to apply for passports. And eventually some official noticed that several hundred people had applied for passports to go to a place called Poitiers, which he had never heard of. So he looked it up on a map and couldn't find it. And all these people were arrested. And eventually, McGregor was arrested too and charged with fraud. He was found guilty at first, but because of connections he had previously made, he was acquitted on appeal on the understanding that he would leave France as quickly as possible. So he then went back to England. He didn't, at that stage, try to persuade any more people to emigrate to Poitiers, but he did try to raise money in the form of bonds and loans for this so-called government of Poitiers, not with much success. Eventually, he took himself back to South America, where he had been part of the Liberation Army. He had actually truly been a general in the Liberation Army in Venezuela. And by that time, his chief was Simon Bolivar. Bolivar was dead by then, and Venezuela was a republic. But the president was one of the old generals from the Revolutionary Wars. So McGregor presented himself in Caracas and said, "I'm a veteran of your revolution, and I was a general, and you owe me a pension." And for political reasons, the president said, "Okay." And so McGregor lived out the last few years of his life in some comfort, just outside Caracas. And he actually has his name inscribed in Caracas Cathedral in the Order of the Liberators.
It's a remarkable story. It truly is. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Sinclair. If you'd like to read this in greater depth, you can look for his book, The Land That Never Was. It's published by DeCapo Press. It's out now in the bookstores. So when he, when Sir Gregor presented himself, styled himself, presented himself as, in effect, a war hero, he had said that he had served under Wellington in the Peninsular Campaign in the Napoleonic Wars,
yeah,
and then did also see this service in South America. There's apparently some question about whether or not his service in the, under Wellington was distinguished, but apparently what he said about his experience in South America actually was true.
Yes, it was to a large extent. It was much embellished. In fact, he'd never fought in the Peninsular Wars. He'd been thrown out of the British Army really before Wellington got going, before the real battle started in the Peninsula, and he had come back to England and he had drifted around a bit, presenting himself as a sort of an aristocrat from various places, and trying to live a playboy's life. He had, at the time, was married to an English woman who had something of a fortune, but she died, and I suspect that her family had some suspicions about McGregor. At any rate, he couldn't get his hands on her money, so he took himself off to South America, which a lot of people from Europe were doing at the time because it was at the height of the revolution against Spain. And a lot of people who'd been in the various armies, not only British and Scottish and Irish, but also from Germany and France and other places in Europe, who no longer had any business, anything to do, took themselves off to South America as mercenaries. And McGregor fetched up in Venezuela in 1812 and presented himself to General Francisco Miranda, who was the commander-in-chief of the revolutionary forces, and said, look, I'm a British Army, an ex-British Army officer. I had a distinguished record against Napoleon, and I think you could probably use my services. And in fact, he did know. He was not a bad soldier. But what seems to have happened is that at some stage, his courage deserted him. He took part in a number of campaigns and served with distinction. And there's a famous story of I think it's a 300-mile retreat through South America being pursued by Spanish forces, which McGregor led with great distinction. But after that, he split with Bolivar and kind of went off on his own as a freebooter. And all the operations he undertook were complete disasters, and several hundred men, women, and children were killed as a result of them. And it was after that that he decided to go back to England and launch the Poyet scheme. Hmm.
So how is it that he met, hooked up with the this king of the Mosquito Coast, not, by the way, named after the insect, that there is some germ of truth to this idea that it may have happened at a drunken party, but he did have this grant of land from this monarch, although later the monarch said, well, I never said he could sell any of it.
Yeah,
how did that happen?
It could well have been. A card game, for example, because McGregor had at one stage invaded Florida, allegedly, to drive out the Spanish. He invaded Amelia Island off the Florida coast, and had made connections with various people who were trading with Latin America. Because at that time, Amelia Island was a kind of haven for pirates. This would have been about 1818. They were either pirates or they were less than honest sea captains with their own ships. And I think what had happened, it's very difficult to trace McGregor's movements because he left very little. There's a very brief fragment of biography, and he doesn't tell us anything about the Poyet scheme at all. So I've had to piece it together from other sources. And what seems to have happened is that McGregor sailed with one of these captains to the Mosquito Shore, met the king at Cap Gracias a Dios, and where there seems to have been a small port with a lot of bars, and it's perfectly possible that it was some kind of gamble, some card game, something like that, which resulted in this grant of land.
This is one of those stories that must have been a sensation in its time, but then later was forgotten. And I think it's always fascinating when stories like this are recovered.
Yeah.
How is it that you heard anything about this at all, and that got you interested, and then you proceeded, obviously had to have to do a lot of research to put the story together, but how did you stumble upon it in the first place?
Well, it was curiously quite by accident. I was living in Ireland at the time, and my wife is Irish, and we were living there, and a friend of hers who has a very old Irish title, the Knight of Glynn, said, I've got a story that I want you to tell. He said, I don't know much about it, but I know that two of my relations were involved in it. And he gave me a quick outline of the MacGregor story. And he also gave me a brief article which had been published in an English historical magazine in the 1950s about MacGregor, most of which incidentally turned out to have been mistaken, but it had the germ of the story in it. And so I followed this up, and I was very, very fortunate to come across, I think, the only copy in private circulation of the fake guidebook that MacGregor had printed in Edinburgh in 1822. I also came across some books written at around the same time, which told fragments of the MacGregor story, and I was able to start to piece it together from those. But it was just this. The Knight of Glynn in Ireland had two relations who were involved with the MacGregor scheme, one of whom had actually given him the accommodation in London, outside London, in the country house, and another one who had been with him in Paris when he tried to float the scheme again. And the concern of my friend was that his ancestors might have been crooks as well. But in fact, from what I could establish from the research, they were as much dupes as anyone else who came into contact with MacGregor.
Although they might have been guilty of being interested in profiting.
Yes,
I suppose
they were.
I suppose though that really is, you know, investing is investing, I guess, and
exactly.
And you wouldn't probably hold that against them.
No, and I think that there's nothing to prove that they actually knew that Poirier wasn't real, because of course, you know, there was not the easy communication that there is today, and most people knew very little about South America other than the sort of books that explorers wrote. And there was actually a race of natives called the Poyes, and there was a town called Poye in Nicaragua now. And so, you know, there was a connection, and they were certainly interested in making money, and they were not terribly interested in looking any more deeply into the scheme than they had to.
Well, certain features of it apparently were plausible enough. That gave it enough of a foundation so that it sounded reasonable, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, with all this documentation, you know, people do tend to believe what they read. And so if you have enough pieces of paper, and when you are presented with this guidebook, which goes into great detail, it even tells you, you know, how much profit you're likely to make from growing coffee in Poye. The fact that the figures actually came from a plantation in America was another matter. But when it's written down, and when it says, you know, this is Senor whoever it is who's been there for so many years, and this is the profit that he makes, and this is what it costs him to do it, then you're inclined to believe it.
Did Sir Gregor write the guidebook himself?
Probably. Again, it's very difficult to establish. The author is listed as a man called Thomas Strangeways, and I think that there's probably a clue. Because a second guidebook was published a little later on, and the author's name was W.R. Goodluck. So I think MacGregor was having a bit of a joke at that point. I'm fairly certain. I can't establish it definitely, but I'm fairly certain that MacGregor wrote the guidebook himself.
Hmm. Well, that seems something of a tribute to his inventiveness and his ability to pull all that together and put something together that would be convincing enough so that at least a reasonable person would look at it and think that it was legitimate.
Yeah, Incidentally, I don't know whether I can say this, but there are some extracts from the guidebook on my website.
Oh, no, absolutely. We'll tell people about that, sure.
Which is just www.dsinclair.net.
All right.
And you can see the copy of the land grant, which was registered in London. And there's also some extracts from the guidebook, and it is very, very convincing.
We have about 8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with David Sinclair. If you'd like to read more of this story, it's to be found in his book, The Land That Never Was, the subtitle Sir Gregor MacGregor and the Most Audacious Fraud in History. It's published by DeCapo, and the story is, as we have outlined, this man, Sir Gregor MacGregor, invented a country in Central America, a place called Poye. Said that it was a beautiful place and encouraged a number of his fellow Scots to pack up everything they had and get onto a boat and sail across the Atlantic and go there with the idea that they would settle and develop that country. The problem is that when they got there, they realized that there was no such place. This is just a question that comes to my mind as I was thinking about your doing the research on the story. Are there a lot of original newspapers extant now from this period so that you could go back and you could read anything that had been written about this?
Yes. No, there are. There's an enormous part of the British Library in London collects copies of all British newspapers as almost as far back as they go. And also, for example, I had an email from someone in Arlington, Massachusetts, who'd come across an article from the Boston Gazette in 1739, which was talking about the Mosquito Indians. Quite a lot was written about it at the time, and you can have access to all this. And also, a number of American universities have done huge amount of research on the Mosquito Shore. And I think there are links in the book. I don't remember them at the moment, but there are links, I think, given in the book or at least on my website, where anyone interested can actually follow this up. And I've had a number of emails from readers in America who, you know, maybe had relatives who had some of the land certificates or some of the investment certificates that MacGregor sold, and I'm trying to trace some of these people and to see what their involvement might have been. It's a story that's going on.
What was the land being sold for? How much was MacGregor asking people to put up to have their opportunity?
Now let me think about this. In English terms, it was between 2 shillings and sixpence and 5 shillings an acre. So that would have been about £12 in modern money, which would have been, I guess, $7. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. And he was selling these in tracts of more than 500 acres?
Yes. The minimum investment was 500 acres. I guess it wasn't worth it, you know, to do it for less.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here in Belgium, which is over near Danville, a neighboring community, on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Been listening to your show. And I wonder, to what extent were the Scottish landlords maybe involved with this to hope that the people moved on along off the property?
Well, I don't, as far as I can make out, and I spent a lot of time in Edinburgh actually researching all this in the National Archives in Scotland. I cannot identify any direct involvement by the Scottish landlords, but there's no doubt that many of them would have been very pleased at a scheme like this. And it may have been part of the reason why it got so much publicity in Scotland, because obviously they wanted to get tenants off their land. So there was at least a kind of tacit support. But as far as I can determine, MacGregor was no more popular among genuine Scottish aristocrats than he was anywhere else. There was an attempt by him to involve the Roman Catholic Church in Scotland to encourage people to emigrate. And his quid pro quo was to purchase for £5,000 at the time, which is what, about £200,000 now, a Roman title from the Pope. He suggested that he might do this if the church would help him. So, you know, there was a certain amount of involvement on the part of the establishment in Scotland, and the landlords would have been part of that too. But I don't think, and I certainly have no evidence, that there was any direct support from the landowning classes in Scotland.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Well, we're about at the point we have to finish. I guess this story invites comparisons to our present day, and I suppose we might like to look back on this and think that these people were gullible in the extreme and that we would be much smarter than that now. Do you think that, in fact, we are?
No, I don't think we are. I think these sort of schemes, you know, we saw the sort of speculation with the dot-com boom, with companies that were never, ever going to make money. I actually was running my financial newspaper at the time, and the kind of prospectuses you saw, that if you spent 5 minutes thinking about them, you knew there was no way this company was ever going to make money. And yet people were investing, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds in such companies. So I think speculation is just part of human nature. And also, there's a desire of people to believe in something. They'd like to believe that these things will work. And I don't think we've changed at all since McGregor's time.
Well, there we must stop. Again, the story is told in the book, The Land That Never Was, by our guest, David Sinclair. It's published by DeCapo Press. Mr. Sinclair, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a great pleasure to be with you this morning.
You've been listening to a Focus 580 program we first broadcast earlier this year. If you'd like to hear some show that you might have missed, or listen to past interviews from the Afternoon Magazine, or hear some of our other local production, it's all available at our website, will.uiuc.edu. It's there and ready for you anytime that you are ready to listen. I'm David Inge. Thanks very much for being with us today. We hope that you will stay tuned. Coming up shortly, the Afternoon Magazine.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Montgomery's on the Square in Monticello, open Tuesdays through Saturday for lunch and dinner, and Sundays for brunch. Montgomery's, an American eclectic cuisine, on the Square in Monticello. 20 minutes from Champaign or Decatur off I-72. Reservations accepted at 762-3833.
It's 11:58, and this is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Jim Meadows, filling in for Celeste Quinn. However, you can hear Celeste Quinn later today when we present an interview from our archives. She'll be talking with Al Jeaney, author of The Importance of Being Lazy. Think of it as an invitation to put your feet up and think about the importance of taking some time off. That's during our 1 o'clock hour. NPR News coming up in just a moment. Right now, let's take a look at the markets. And looking at May corn, it's reporting 244 down 2. August soybeans, we're taking these out of sequence. And I'll start again with the wheat, September wheat, at 301.5 down 3.25. December wheat at 315.5 down 4.